Did you know the Sleepy Bookshelf has a sibling podcast with all original stories and meditations? It's called Get Sleepy, and I'm sure you'll love it. I even narrate some of the stories. Just search for Get Sleepy in your preferred podcast player. Thank you, and sweet dreams. Good evening, and welcome to the Sleepy Bookshelf, where we put down our worries from the day and pick up a good book. I'm your host, Elizabeth. Thank you for joining me tonight, as this evening we read the next pages of Emma. Before we begin, let's take some time to get comfortable in bed. Once you've found a cozy spot, take a deep breath in, and then a great big sigh, and let it all go. Work your way up from your toes all the way to your eyebrows, gently tensing and releasing each muscle in your body. You can go back and repeat any areas that you feel need extra attention. Keep doing that, and don't worry about falling asleep tonight. We all drift off in our own time. Allow your mind to be enticed into this light-hearted story and move away from any thoughts from the day that are trying to steal your focus. Last time, Emma and her father, Mr. Woodhouse, had just been to the wedding of their very good friend and Emma's governess, Miss Taylor, to the locally esteemed widow, Mr. Weston. Miss Taylor had been with the family since Emma was 5 years old, after her mother passed away, and as Emma had grown up, Miss Taylor had become her confidant. To dissuade her father from falling into a bad mood about the loss of Miss Taylor, Emma cheerily suggested they arrange a visit to the newlyweds, when they were interrupted by Mr. Knightley, a good-natured, long-time family friend who always brought joy to Mr. Woodhouse. He was also the only person in Emma's acquaintance who would ever pick fault with her. Emma expressed joy in being the matchmaker for Mr. Weston and Miss Taylor 4 years previous, but Mr. Knightley had doubts about her involvement. Mr. Weston had a son by his previous wife. She had died just 3 years after they married. Her family, the very wealthy Churchills, had denounced her choice of husband. However, after her death, her aunt and uncle offered to take in the boy. Mr. Weston was poorer than ever and agreed, using the next 18 years to become a self-made tradesman. He bought an extension to his property and fell in love with Miss Taylor. At the announcement of the wedding, his son Frank had expressed a wish to come and visit his father and his new wife. And that is where we pick up tonight, with the introduction of a few more people in Mr. Woodhouse's circle. So, just lie back and relax as I turn to the next pages of Emma. Volume 1, Chapter 3. Mr. Woodhouse was fond of society in his own way. He liked very much to have his friends come and see him, and from various united causes, from his long residence at Hartfield, and his good nature, from his fortune, his house, and his daughter, he could command the visits of his own little circle in a great measure as he liked. He had not much intercourse with any families beyond that circle, His horror of late hours and large dinner parties made him unfit for any acquaintance but such as would visit him on his own terms. Fortunately for him, Highbury, including Randalls in the same parish, and Donwell Abbey in the parish adjoining, the seat of Mr. Knightley, comprehended many such. Not unfrequently, through Emma's persuasion, he had some of the chosen and the best to dine with him. But evening parties were what he preferred, and unless he fancied himself at any time unequal to company, there was scarcely an evening in the week in which Emma could not make up a card table for him. Real, long-standing regard brought the Westons and Mr. Knightley, and by Mr. Elton, a young man living alone without liking it, the privilege of exchanging any vacant evening of his own, blank solitude, for the elegancies and society of Mr. Woodhouse's drawing room, and the smiles of his lovely daughter, was in no danger of being thrown away. After these came a second set, among the most comatible of whom were Mrs. and Miss Bates and Mrs. Goddard, three ladies almost always at the service of an invitation from Hartfield, and who were fetched and carried home so often that Mr. Woodhouse thought it no hardship for either James or the horses. Had it taken place only once a year, it would have been a grievance. Mrs. Bates, the widow of a former vicar of Highbury, was a very old lady, almost past everything but tea and quadrille. She lived with her single daughter in a very small way, and was considered with all the regard and respect which a harmless old lady, under such untoward circumstances, can excite. Her daughter enjoyed a most uncommon degree of popularity for a woman neither young, handsome, rich, nor married. Miss Bates stood in the very worst predicament in the world for having much of the public favour, and she had no intellectual superiority to make atonement to herself, or frighten those who might hate her into outward respect. She had never boasted either beauty or cleverness. Her youth had passed without distinction, and her middle of life was devoted to the care of a failing mother and the endeavour to make a small income go as far as possible. And yet she was a happy woman, and a woman whom no one named without goodwill. It was her own universal goodwill and contented temper which worked such wonders. She loved everybody, was interested in everybody's happiness, quick-sighted to everybody's merits, thought herself a most fortunate creature, and surrounded with blessings in such an excellent mother, and so many good neighbours and friends, and a home that wanted for nothing. The simplicity and cheerfulness of her nature, her contented and grateful spirit, were a recommendation to everybody and a mine of felicity to herself. She was a great talker upon little matters, which exactly suited Mr. Woodhouse, full of trivial communications and harmless gossip. Mrs. Goddard was the mistress of a school, not of a seminary or an establishment, or anything which professed, in long sentences of refined nonsense, to combine liberal acquirements with elegant morality, upon new principles and new systems, and where young ladies for enormous pay might be screwed out of health and into vanity. But a real, honest, old-fashioned boarding school, where a reasonable quantity of accomplishments were sold at a reasonable price, and where girls might be sent to be out of the way and scramble themselves into a little education without any danger of coming back prodigies. Mrs. Goddard's school was in high repute, and very deservedly, for Highbury was reckoned a particularly healthy spot. She had an ample house and garden, gave the children plenty of wholesome food, let them run about a great deal in the summer, and in winter dressed their chilblains with her own hands. It was no wonder that a train of 20 young couple now walked after her to church. She was a plain, motherly kind of woman, who had worked hard in her youth, and now thought herself entitled to the occasional holiday of a tea visit, and having formerly owed much to Mr. Woodhouse's kindness, felt his particular claim on her to leave her neat parlour, hung round with fancy work, whenever she could, and win or lose a few sixpences by his fireside. These were the ladies whom Emma found herself very frequently able to collect, and happy was she, for her father's sake, in the power, though as far as she was herself concerned, it was no remedy for the absence of Mrs. Weston. She was delighted to see her father look comfortable, and very much pleased with herself for contriving things so well. But the quiet prosings of three such women made her feel that every evening so spent was indeed one of the long evenings she had fearfully anticipated. As she sat one morning, looking forward to exactly such a close of the present day, a note was brought from Mrs. Goddard requesting, in most respectful terms, to be allowed to bring Miss Smith with her, a most welcome request. For Miss Smith was a girl of 17, whom Emma knew very well by sight, and had long felt an interest in on account of her beauty. A very gracious invitation was returned, and the evening no longer dreaded by the fair mistress of the mansion. Harriet Smith was the natural daughter of somebody. Somebody had placed her, several years back, at Mrs. Goddard's school, and somebody had lately raised her from the condition of scholar to that of parlour boarder. This was all that was generally known of her history. She had no visible friends but what had been acquired at Highbury, and was now just returned from a long visit in the country to some young ladies who had been at school there with her. She was a very pretty girl, and her beauty happened to be of a sort which Emma particularly admired. She was short, plump, and fair, with a fine bloom, blue eyes, light hair, regular features, and a look of great sweetness. And before the end of the evening, Emma was as much pleased with her manners as her person, and quite determined to continue the acquaintance. She was not struck by anything remarkably clever in Miss Smith's conversation, but she found her altogether very engaging. Not inconveniently shy, not unwilling to talk, and yet so far from pushing, showing so proper and becoming a deference, seeming so pleasantly grateful for being admitted to Hartfield, and so artlessly impressed by the appearance of everything, in so superior a style to what she had been used to, that she must have good sense and deserve encouragement. Encouragement should be given. Those soft blue eyes and all those natural graces should not be wasted on the inferior society of Highbury and its connections. The acquaintance she had already formed were unworthy of her. The friends from whom she had just parted, though very good sort of people, must be doing her harm. They were a family of the name Martin, whom Emma well knew by character as renting a large farm of Mr. Knightley and residing in the parish of Donwell. Very creditably, she believed. She knew Mr. Knightley thought highly of them. But they must be coarse and unpolished and very unfit to be the inmates of a girl who wanted only a little more knowledge and elegance to be quite perfect. She would notice her. She would improve her. She would detach her from her bad acquaintance and introduce her into good society. She would form her opinions and manners. It would be an interesting and certainly a very kind undertaking. Highly becoming her own situation in life, her leisure and powers. She was so busy in admiring those soft blue eyes, in talking and listening and forming all these schemes in the in-betweens, that the evening flew away at a very unusual rate, and the supper table, which always closed such parties, and for which she had been used to sit and watch the due time, was all set out and ready and moved forwards to the fire before she was aware. With an alacrity beyond the common impulse of a spirit which yet was never indifferent to the credit of doing everything well and attentively, with the real goodwill of a mind delighted with its own ideas, did she then do all the honours of the meal, and help and recommend the minced chicken and scalloped oysters with an urgency which she knew would be acceptable to the early hours and civil scruples of their guests. Upon such occasions, poor Mr. Woodhouse's feelings were in sad warfare. He loved to have the cloth laid, because it had been the fashion of his youth. But his conviction of suppers being very unwholesome made him rather sorry to see anything put on it. And while his hospitality would have welcomed his visitors to everything, his care for their health made him grieve that they would eat. Such another small basin of thin gruel as his own was all that he could, with thorough self-approbation, recommend. Though he might constrain himself, while the ladies were comfortably clearing the nicer things, to say,
"Mrs. Bates, let me propose your venturing on one of these eggs. An egg boiled very soft is not unwholesome. Searle understands boiling an egg better than anybody. I would not recommend an egg boiled by anybody else, but you need not be afraid. They are very small, you see. One of our small eggs will not hurt you. Miss Bates, let Emma help you to a little bit of tart, a very little bit. Ours are all apple tarts. You need not be afraid of unwholesome preserves here. I do not advise the custard. Mrs. Goddard, what say you to half a glass of wine? A small half glass put into a tumbler of water. I do not think it could disagree with you."
Emma allowed her father to talk, but supplied her visitors in a much more satisfactory style, and on the present evening had particular pleasure in sending them away happy. The happiness of Miss Smith was quite equal to her intentions. Miss Woodhouse was so great a personage in Highbury that the prospect of the introduction had given as much panic as pleasure. But the humble, grateful little girl went off with highly gratified feelings, delighted with the affability with which Miss Woodhouse had treated her all the evening and actually shaken hands with her at last. Volume 1, Chapter 4. Harriet Smith's intimacy at Hartfield was soon a settled thing. Quick and decided in her ways, Emma lost no time in inviting, encouraging, and telling her to come very often. And as their acquaintance increased, so did their satisfaction in each other. As a walking companion, Emma had very early foreseen how useful she might find her. In that respect, Mrs. Weston's loss had been important. Her father never went beyond the shrubbery, where the two divisions of the ground sufficed him for his long walk or his short as the year varied. And since Mrs. Weston's marriage, her exercise had been too much confined. She had ventured once alone to Randall's, but it was not pleasant, and a Harriet Smith, therefore, one whom she could summon at any time to a walk, would be a valuable addition to her privileges. But in every respect, as she saw more of her, she approved her, and was confirmed in all her kind designs. Harriet certainly was not clever, but she had a sweet, docile, grateful disposition, was totally free from conceit, and only desiring to be guided by anyone she looked up to. Her early attachment to herself was very amiable, and her inclination for good company and power of appreciating what was elegant and clever showed that there was no want of taste, though strength of understanding must not be expected. Altogether, she was quite convinced of Harriet Smith's being exactly the young friend she wanted, exactly the something which her home required. Such a friend as Mrs. Weston was out of the question. Two such could never be granted. Two such she did not want. It was quite a different sort of thing, a sentiment distinct and independent. Mrs. Weston was the object of a regard which had its basis in gratitude and esteem. Harriet would be loved as one to whom she could be useful. For Mrs. Weston, there was nothing to be done. For Harriet, everything. Her first attempts at usefulness were in an endeavour to find out who were the parents, but Harriet could not tell. She was ready to tell everything in her power, but on this subject, questions were vain. Emma was obliged to fancy what she liked, but she could never believe that in the same situation she should not have discovered the truth. Harriet had no penetration. She had been satisfied to hear and believe just what Mrs. Goddard chose to tell her, and looked no further. Mrs. Goddard and the teachers and the girls and the affairs of the school in general formed naturally a great part of the conversation, and but for her acquaintance with the Martins of Abbey Mill Farm, it must have been the whole. But the Martins occupied her thoughts a good deal. She had spent two very happy months with them, and now loved to talk of the pleasures of her visit, and describe the many comforts and wonders of the place. Emma encouraged her talkativeness, amused by such a picture of another set of beings, and enjoying the youthful simplicity which could speak with so much exultation of Mrs. Martin's having two parlours, two very good parlours indeed, one of them quite as large as Mrs. Goddard's drawing room, and of her having an upper maid who had lived 25 years with her, and of their having 8 cows, 2 of them Alderneys, and 1 little Welsh cow, a very pretty little Welsh cow indeed, and of Mrs. Martin's saying, as she was so fond of it, it should be called her cow, and of their having a very handsome summer house in their garden, where some day next year they were all to drink tea. A very handsome summer house, large enough to hold 12 people. For some time she was amused without thinking beyond the immediate cause, but as she came to understand the family better, other feelings arose. She had taken up a wrong idea, fancying it was a mother and daughter, a son and son's wife, who all lived together. But when it appeared that the Mr. Martin, who bore a part in the narrative, and was always mentioned with approbation for his great good nature in doing something or other, was a single man, that there was no young Mrs. Martin, no wife in the case, she did suspect danger to her poor little friend from all this hospitality and kindness, and that if she were not taken care of, she might be required to sink herself forever. With this inspiriting notion, her questions increased in number and meaning. She particularly led Harriet to talk more of Mr. Martin, and there was evidently no dislike to it. Harriet was very ready to speak of the share he had had in their moonlight walks and merry evening games, and dwelt a good deal upon his being so very good-humoured and obliging. He had gone 3 miles round one day in order to bring her some walnuts, because she had said how fond she was of them. And in everything else, he was so very obliging. He had his shepherd's son into the parlour one night on purpose to sing to her. She was very fond of singing. He could sing a little himself. She believed he was very clever and understood everything. He had a very fine flock, and while she was with them, he had been bid more for his wool than anybody in the country. She believed everybody spoke well of him. His mother and sisters were very fond of him. Mrs. Martin had told her one day, and there was a blush as she said it, that it was impossible for anybody to be a better son, and therefore she was sure whenever he married, he would make a good husband. Not that she wanted him to marry. She was in no hurry at all. "Well done, Mrs. Martin," thought Emma. "You know what you're about." And when she had come away, Mrs. Martin was so very kind as to send Mrs. Goddard a beautiful goose, the finest goose Mrs. Goddard had ever seen. Mrs. Goddard had dressed it on a Sunday and asked all 3 teachers, Miss Nash and Miss Prince and Miss Richardson, to sup with her. Mr. Martin, I suppose, is not a man of information beyond the line of his own business. He does not read. Oh, yes. Oh, that is, no. I do not know. But I believe he has read a good deal, but not what you would think anything of. He reads the agricultural reports and some other books that lay in one of the window seats, but he reads all them to himself. Sometimes of an evening, before we went to cards, he would read something aloud and out of the Elegant Extract. Very entertaining. And I know he has read The Vicar of Wakefield. He never read The Romance of Forest, nor The Children of the Abbey. He had never heard of such books before I mentioned them. but he is determined to get them now as soon as ever he can. The next question was, what sort of looking man is Mr. Martin? Oh, not handsome. Not at all handsome. I thought him very plain at first, but I do not think him so plain now. One does not, you know, after a time. But did you never see him? He is in Highbury every now and then, and he is sure to ride through every week on his way to Kingston. He has passed you very often. That may be, and I may have seen him 50 times, but without having any idea of his name, a young farmer, whether on horseback or on foot, is the very last sort of person to raise my curiosity. The yeomanry are precisely the order of people with whom I feel I can have nothing to do. A degree or two lower, and a creditable appearance might interest me. I might hope to be useful to their families in some way or other. But a farmer can need none of my help, and is therefore, in one sense, as much above my notice as in every other he is below it. To be sure, oh yes, it is not likely you should ever have observed him, but he knows you very well indeed. I mean, by sight. I have no doubt of his being a very respectable young man. I know indeed that he is so, and, as such, wish him well. What do you imagine his age to be? He was 24 on the 8th of last June, and my birthday is the 23rd. Just a fortnight and a day's difference, which is very odd. Only 24. That is too young to settle. His mother is perfectly right not to be in a hurry. They seem very comfortable as they are, and if she were to take any pains to marry him, she would probably repent it. 6 years hence, if he could meet with a good sort of woman in the same rank as his own, with a little money, it might be very desirable. 6 years hence? Dear Miss Woodhouse, he would be 30 years old. Well, and that is as early as most men can afford to marry, who are not born to an independence. Mr. Martin, I imagine, has his fortune entirely to make. Cannot be at all beforehand with the world. Whatever money he might come into when his father died, whatever his share of the family property, it is, I dare say, all afloat, all employed in his stock and so forth. And though, with diligence and good luck, he may be rich in time, it is next to impossible that he should have realised anything yet. To be sure, so it is. But they live very comfortably. They have no indoors man, else they do not want for anything else. And Mrs. Martin talks of taking a boy another year. I wish you may not get into a scrape, Harriet, whenever he does marry. I mean, as to being acquainted with his wife, for although his sisters, from a superior education, are not to be altogether objected to, it does not follow that he might marry anybody at all fit for you to notice. The misfortune of your birth ought to make you particularly careful as to your associates. There can be no doubt of your being a gentleman's daughter, and you must support your claim to that station by everything within your power, or there will be plenty of people who will take pleasure in degrading you. Yes, to be sure there are. I suppose there are. But while I visit at Hartfield, and you are so kind to me, Miss Woodhouse, I'm not afraid of what anybody can do. You understand the force of influence pretty well, Harriet, but I would have you so firmly established in good society as to be independent, even of Hartfield and Miss Woodhouse. I want to see you permanently well connected, and to that end, it will be advisable to have as few odd acquaintances as may be. And, therefore, I say that if you should still be in this country when Mr. Martin marries, I wish you may not be drawn in by your intimacy with the sisters to be acquainted with the wife, who will probably be some mere farmer's daughter without education. To
to be sure. Yes. Not that I think Mr. Martin would ever marry anybody but what had had some education and been very well brought up. However, I do not mean to set up my opinion against yours, and I'm sure I shall not wish for the acquaintance of his wife. I shall always have a great regard for the Miss Martins, especially Elizabeth, and should be very sorry to give them up, for they are quite as well educated as me. But if he marries a very ignorant, vulgar woman, certainly I had better not visit her if I can help it.
Emma watched her through the fluctuations of this speech and saw no alarming symptoms of love. The young man had been the first admirer, but she trusted there was no other hold, and that there would be no serious difficulty on Harriet's side to oppose any friendly arrangement of her own. They met Mr. Martin the very next day as they were walking on the Donwell Road. He was on foot, and after looking very respectfully at her, looked with most unfeigned satisfaction at her companion. Emma was not sorry to have such an opportunity of survey, and walking a few yards forward while they talked together, soon made her quick eye sufficiently acquainted with Mr. Robert Martin. His appearance was very neat, and he looked like a sensible young man, but his position had no other advantage, and when he came to be contrasted with gentlemen, she thought he must lose all the ground he had gained in Harriet's inclination. Harriet was not insensible of manner. She had voluntarily noticed her father's gentleness with admiration as well as wonder. Mr. Martin looked as if he did not know what manner was. They remained but a few minutes together, as Miss Woodhouse must not be kept waiting, and Harriet then came running to her with a smiling face and in a flutter of spirits, which Miss Woodhouse hoped very soon to compose.
"Only think of our happening to meet him. How very odd. It was quite a chance," he said, "that he had not gone round by Randall's. He did not think we ever walked this road. He thought we walked towards Randall's most days. He has not been able to get the Romance of the Forest yet. He was so busy last time he was at Kingston that he had quite forgot it, but he goes again tomorrow. So very odd we should happen to meet. Well, Miss Woodhouse, is he like what you expected? What do you think of him? Do you think him so very plain?" "He is very plain, undoubtedly. Remarkably plain. But that is nothing compared with his entire want of gentility. I had no right to expect much, and did not expect much. But I had no idea that he could be so very clownish, so totally without air. I had imagined him, I confess, a degree or two nearer gentility." "To be sure," said Harriet in a mortified voice. "He is not so genteel as real gentlemen. I think, Harriet, since your acquaintance with us, you have been repeatedly in the company of some such very real gentleman that you must yourself be struck with the difference in Mr. Martin. At Hartfield, you have had very good specimens of well-educated, well-bred men. I should be surprised if, after seeing them, you should be in company with Mr. Martin again, without perceiving him to be a very inferior creature, and rather wondering at yourself for having ever thought him at all agreeable before. Do you not begin to feel that now? Were you not struck? I'm sure you must have been struck by his awkward look and abrupt manner, and the uncouthness of a voice which I heard to be unwholly unmodulated as I stood there. Certainly, he is not like Mr. Knightley. He has not such a fine air and a way of walking as Mr. Knightley. I see the difference plain enough. But Mr. Knightley is so very fine a man. Mr. Knightley's air is so remarkably good that it is not fair to compare Mr. Martin with him. You might not see 1 in 100 with gentlemen so plainly written as in Mr. Knightley. But he is not the only gentleman you have been lately used to. What say you to Mr. Weston and Mr. Elton? Compare Mr. Martin with either of them. Compare their manner of carrying themselves, of walking, of speaking, of being silent. You must see the difference. Oh, yes, there is a great difference. But Mr. Weston is almost an old man. Mr. Weston must be between 40 and 50, which makes his good manners the more valuable. The older a person grows, Harriet, the more important it is that their manners should not be bad, the more glaring and disgusting any loudness or coarseness or awkwardness becomes. What is passable in youth is detestable in later age. Mr. Martin is now awkward and abrupt. What will he be at Mr. Weston's time of life? There is no saying indeed,
replied Harriet, rather solemnly.
But there may be pretty good guessing. He will be completely gross, vulgar farmer, totally inattentive to appearances, and thinking of nothing but profit and loss. Will he indeed? That will be very bad. How much his business engrosses him already is very plain from the circumstance of his forgetting to inquire for the book you recommended. He was a great deal too full of the market to think of anything else, which is just as it should be for a thriving man. What has he to do with books? And I have no doubt that he will thrive and be a very rich man in time. And his being illiterate and coarse need not disturb us. I wonder he did not remember the book,
was all Harriet's answer, and spoken with a degree of grave displeasure, which Emma thought might be safely left to itself. She therefore said no more for some time. Her next beginning was,
in one respect, perhaps Mr. Elton's manners are superior to Mr. Knightley's or Mr. Weston's. They have more gentleness. They might be more safely held up as a pattern. There is an openness, a quickness, almost a bluntness in Mr. Weston, which everybody likes in him because there is so much good humour with it. But that would not do to be copied. Neither would Mr. Knightley's downright, decided, commanding sort of manner, though it suits him very well. His figure and look and situation in life seem to allow it, but if any young man were to set about copying him, he would not be sufferable. On the contrary, I think a young man might be very safely recommended to take Mr. Elton as a model. Mr. Elton is good-humoured, cheerful, obliging and gentle. He seems to me to be grown particularly gentle of late. I do not know whether he has any design of ingratiating himself with either of us, Harriet, by additional softness, but it strikes me that his manners are softer than they used to be. If he means anything, must be to please you. Did I not tell you what he said of you the other day?
She then repeated some warm, personal praise which she had drawn from Mr. Elton, and now did full justice to. And Harriet blushed and smiled, and said she had always thought Mr. Elton very agreeable. Mr. Elton was the very person fixed on by Emma for driving the young farmer out of Harriet's head. She thought it would be an excellent match, and only too palpably desirable, natural, and probable,
for her to have much merit in planning it. She feared it was what everybody else must think of and predict. It was not likely, however, that anybody should have equaled her in the date of the plan, as it had entered her brain during the very first evening of Harriet's coming to Hartfield. The longer she considered it, the greater was her sense of its expediency. Mr. Elton's situation was most suitable. Quite the gentleman himself, and without low connections, at the same time, not of any family that could fairly object to the doubtful birth of Harriet. He had a comfortable home for her, and Emma imagined a very sufficient income, for though the vicarage of Highbury was not large, he was known to have some independent property, and she thought very highly of him as a good-humoured, well-meaning, respectable young man, without any deficiency of useful understanding or knowledge of the world. She had already satisfied herself that he thought Harriet a beautiful girl, which she trusted, with such frequent meetings at Hartfield, was foundation enough on his side, and on Harriet's there could be little doubt that the idea of being preferred by him would have all the usual weight and efficacy. And he really was a very pleasing young man. A young man whom any woman not fastidious might like. He was reckoned by very handsome, his person much admired in general, though not by her, there being a want of elegance of feature which she could not dispense with. But the girl who could be gratified by a Robert Martin's riding about the country to get walnuts for her might very well be conquered by Mr. Elton's admiration.